Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting another missile test launch from North Korea, sparking outrage from some in the international community, as well as a show of military might. Saturday, the U.S. Air Force flew two B-1B bombers over the Korean Peninsula, accompanied by South Korean and Japanese jet fighters. The U.S. Pacific Command acknowledged this was in direct response to North Korea's escalatory launch of intercontinental ballistic missiles on July 3rd and July 28th. Also Saturday, U.S. President Donald Trump again criticized China for failing to stop North Korea's ballistic missile and nuclear weapons programs. Mr. Trump's remarks echoed those made by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who released a statement that blamed both China and Russia for North Korea's continued violations of UN Security Council resolutions. Venezuelans at the polls this Sunday for a controversial vote called for by President Nicolas Maduro. Voters casting ballots for a constituent assembly whose 545 members will be charged with rewriting the country's constitution. Critics assert that only Maduro supporters are candidates and that they could revise the constitution to keep him in office indefinitely. The political opposition is urging a boycott of the vote, which leaves only supporters of the president to cast the ballots. The opposition says the vote is fraudulent and has caused four demonstrations. Protests early in the week gave way to a tense calm Friday and Saturday after Maduro banned public demonstrations through next Tuesday. Maduro said anyone defying the ban risks up to 10 years in prison. This is VOA News. Several people, at least 10, killed and 15 others wounded in a massive suicide car bomb attack in the Somali capital. The car that exploded was in a queue of vehicles on Mogadishu's busiest street. A VOA Somali service reporter who went to the scene said the car was stuck in a traffic jam due to intensive stops and search operations by the security forces. The bomber then detonated the car filled with explosives, killing 7 people initially at the scene. 3 more people later died. Most of the victims were shoppers caught in the explosion as it came out of a market on the side of the road. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says police prevented a terrorist conspiracy to bring down an aircraft. Investigators say they have information the plan to blow up an aircraft involved the use of an improvised device. 4 men have been detained following the raids across Sydney Saturday by heavily armed police and members of Australia's domestic spy agency. A woman who said her son and husband were among those arrested has denied that any of them had any ties to extremism. Turnbull says that this is what appears to be an elaborate conspiracy.
We have the finest security, police, intelligence services in the world. The major counterterrorism operation which has occurred is an example of the way in which terrorist plots are uncovered and disrupted due to the extraordinary intelligence services we have and the fine cooperation they have with our police and security agencies.
Since 2014, 70 people have been charged as a result of more than 30 counterterrorism raids across the country. Apple Inc. has confirmed that it is removing some applications providing virtual personal networks, they're also called VPNs, from its China App Store. This is to comply with new Chinese regulations, a move critics say is capitulating to internet censorship. Apple confirmed the move in an email to National Public Radio after several VPN providers announced that their apps had been removed from the China App Store. Software made outside China can sometimes be used to get around China's domestic internet firewalls that block content that the government finds objectionable. Critics call China's Great Firewall one of the world's most advanced censorship systems. 7 Turkish journalists were freed from prison after 9 months Saturday, but they have expressed sorrow that 4 of their colleagues are still detained on charges of aiding terror groups. Staff members of a Turkish opposition newspaper were released. They must still stand trial, though. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impulga. Peter Glotte has the day off.
As I told you, yes, there was an IED and ambush on a platoon, and two soldiers were injured and they have been airlifted to Mogadishu's level 2 hospital.
At least 10 people have been killed in a massive suicide car bomb attack in the Somali capital Mogadishu, and Al-Shabaab militants ambush a convoy of African Union vehicles.
We know that from the economy to stability and peace, we're not able to achieve our goals if we're only investing in half of the population.
A UN official calls for investing more in women in order to achieve the sustainable development goals.
She have a lot of customers, Ethiopians, Kenyans, some white peoples. Now also the South African people also, they came and they enjoy for our traditional foods.
And South Africans finally learn to appreciate the food and recipes of their home continent. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. At least 10 people have been killed and 15 others wounded in a massive suicide car attack in the Somali capital Mogadishu. According to witnesses and security forces, the car that exploded Sunday was in a queue of vehicles on Maka al-Makarama Road, Mogadishu's busiest street. Meanwhile, Al-Shabaab militants have ambushed a convoy of African Union vehicles near Goloyen village in Lower Shabelle region, killing at least 10 AU soldiers and one Somali soldier, according to the region's deputy governor, Ali Nur Muhammad. Goloyen is 120 kilometers south of Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab claimed killing 39 AU soldiers. AU military spokesperson Wilson Rono confirmed the ambush in an interview with VOA Somali Service, but denied Al-Shabaab claims.
As I told you, yes, there was an IED and ambush on a platoon, and two soldiers were injured and they have been airlifted to Mogadishu's level 2 hospital. Those reports that Al-Shabaab is putting on their website, on their social media, that they killed 39 is really false, because a platoon does not even have 39 personnel. A platoon does not have a general, as they say.
The information we have is that although they claimed 39 were killed, we also spoke to the deputy governor of Lower Shabelle region, and he says at least 10 AMISOM soldiers were killed.
The report I'm getting from the commanders of that contingent is that the two were injured.
So no AMISOM deaths?
Yes, no AMISOM death.
Can you shed a light exactly what happened, as you heard?
Okay, this was a resupply convoy. And as usual, there was the IED attack that was followed by an ambush.
And did the convoy continue its journey, or was it halted by the ambush?
Well, it did not continue, but it was reinforced by reinforcements from the FOB nearby, and they went back.
FOB is Forward Operation Base.
Yes.
That was AU military spokesman Wilson Rono. He spoke with my colleague Haruna Maruf of VOA's Somali Service. Meanwhile, in neighboring Kenya, police say one of their officers died when a gunman carried out an attack on the deputy president's residence. Kenya's police chief, Joseph Boynet, said Sunday that the gunman had also been shot and killed, and that the situation is under control. Police initially said the attacker was armed with a machete. The motive for the attack was not immediately clear. Deputy President William Ruto and his family were not home at the time of the attack. Ruto is the running mate of President Uhuru Kenyatta, who is seeking a second term in office in the upcoming elections. Thank you. Three African nations are holding major elections in August: Angola, Kenya, and Rwanda. Although the three nations are very different, for all, the stakes are high and the contests will be closely watched. VOA's Anita Paul has more from Johannesburg.
First up is tiny, landlocked Rwanda, which will vote the first week in August. Once again, the undisputed favorite is the longtime president, Paul Kagame, who has ruled Rwanda since the end of the 1994 genocide. Horn of Africa analyst Mariti Mutiga of the International Crisis Group is expecting no surprises, but says the democratic exercise is an important one for Rwanda and its wealthy aid partners.
I think it matters to the extent that obviously there's been questions as to whether Rwanda is an authoritarian country, whether it respects the norms and practices of a democratic country, and especially as a major recipient of aid from the West.
In Kenya, the August 8th poll will be a tight contest between incumbent president Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga. The European Union has decided not to send observers to Rwanda, but to deploy more than 100 observers to Kenya. Odinga's disputed loss in the 2007 election sparked weeks of political and ethnic violence across Kenya, taking the lives of more than 1,100 people. Since then, constitutional reforms have been implemented to prevent such violence. Mutiga says the August poll is a test of whether those reforms can hold.
This time, just as in 2007, the outcome will be close, the stakes are high for the candidates, and the institutions, especially the Electoral Commission, are struggling to cope with the huge responsibility on their shoulders.
Last is the oil juggernaut, Angola. On August 23rd, the Southern African nation will hold its first vote in decades without President José Eduardo dos Santos at the helm. The 74-year-old, who has taken several trips to Spain for medical reasons, is stepping down after 38 years in power. The poll itself is a straightforward two-way race between the longtime ruling party and the established opposition. Analyst Maya Bojon of business consulting firm Verisk Maplecroft told VOA that the real test will come after the election, when the new president will have to address slumping oil revenue, a foundering economy, and gaping inequalities. To do so, she says, the winner will have to untangle the complicated network of state resources, which remain largely controlled by President Dos Santos and his family. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A UN official says northeast Nigeria's problems are principally due to long-term development failures compounded by a Boko Haram terrorist insurgency that's provoked a crisis of global magnitude. UN Development Programme Resident Representative for Nigeria, Edward Kalan, who is also UN Humanitarian Coordinator there, adds that nearly 2 million Nigerians have been internally displaced, while hundreds of thousands fled to neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, countries which have also been deeply affected by Boko Haram violence. Matt Wells asked Mr. Kalan to outline UNDP's priorities.
The problems in Northeast are due principally to development failures over the years, which have been compounded by human rights, governance deficit, poverty, and climate vulnerabilities.
And, of course, the Boko Haram insurgency.
Correct. We are dealing with a crisis of global magnitude in Northeast Nigeria as a result of the Boko Haram insurgency, which started way back in 2009, and an estimated 20,000 people have been killed as a result of that insurgency. We are talking about a serious protection concern with over 1.9 million people displaced, 14 million people affected, of which 8.5 million people need urgent humanitarian assistance. But the crisis should be also seen as an opportunity in the sense to try for once again to look at the root causes of that crisis.
It's interesting that you say that the development deficit was there and has been there for many decades, it seems.
For many, many
and
decades.
And the insurgency has just exposed that.
It's that the insurgency has just compounded it. We started off with a very clear vision in Northeast Nigeria to try to save lives in the short term, but try to build it around a resilience-based approach. And we define resilience in the Northeast Nigeria as an approach where we can help people to cope with the impact of the crisis, the Boko Haram insurgency, and also support them to recover from those impact of this crisis and engage in transformative change. The United Nations Development Programme came in with to link the transition from humanitarian assistance into early recovery and longer-term development.
What is it that you need most to happen in the next few months in order to help to really dampen down effectively the effects of the insurgency and the return of these many hundreds of thousands of people?
We need peace. We need a solution to the Boko Haram insurgency. And we also need a political process to complement the ongoing military effort so that we can try to engage with all parties to this conflict to find durable solutions. And we also need some levels of investment, especially from the government of Nigeria, to support people to start rebuilding their lives. And I also call on the international community to provide the required resources that will enable the international community to save lives in the short term, but also invest in early recovery development moving ahead.
That was UN Development Programme Resident Representative for Nigeria, Edward Callan. He spoke with UN's Matt Wells in New York. Achieving the Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, will not be possible without investing more in women, according to UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed, who led a high-level group of women leaders to two African countries this month. Joining Ms. Mohammed in Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo were the Executive Director of UN Women, the UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict, and the African Union Special Envoy on Women, Peace and Security. UN Radio's Dan Pien reports.
Speaking during their first stop in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, Ms. Mohammed stated that the delegation had come to the continent to discuss the general issues of peace, security and development with an emphasis on women's rights and empowerment.
We know that from the economy to stability and peace, we're not able to achieve our goals if we're only investing in half of the population. It is a nation and a continent's greatest asset, the human resource. Women are often half of it, but lack the investments that we need.
The 17 Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, have been described as a to-do list for creating a world where no one is left behind. They were agreed by world leaders 2 years ago and have a deadline of 2030. Ms. Mohammed noted that the push for sustainable development had become more complex in recent years, and although SDGs such as ending extreme poverty and providing education were important, new factors had to be taken into account.
The context that we are living in is that of conflict, extremism that is within many of our countries, and in particular Nigeria. So here, what we really want to do is to hear and bring the messages of women. Women in decision-making, women who bear the brunt and carry the burden of many of the tragedies that we see, to see how we can come out of this, how we can be a constructive partner in finding the solutions to sustainable development.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo has also been plagued by conflict and other challenges, and the UN deputy chief said the delegation hoped the DRC's women will help to change the narrative. At a meeting with officials in the capital, Kinshasa, she also outlined aspirations related to the elections slated to be held before the end of the year. Ms. Mohammed said women must be part of the process.
DRC is exceptional in that it has a constitution, it has a law, but it must reinforce that law to implement the participation and parity of women. A parity of women beyond the numbers, to see them in decision-making, to see a very good opportunity for monitoring of the elections, that it is inclusive, that it is fair, that opposition itself has a place, because in every democracy, a vibrant opposition is the integrity and the hope for strengthening the foundations for democracy.
UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed speaking to reporters in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
That was UN Radio's Diane Penn reporting from New York. Last week, on the eve of World Hepatitis Day, the World Health Organization called for stepped-up action to eliminate hepatitis B and C by 2030. It says the goal can be reached by scaling up diagnosis, a treatment and prevention of the disease, which can cause a death from cirrhosis and liver cancer. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports viral hepatitis B and C affected 325 million people and caused 1.34 million deaths in 2015. The WHO is calling for the elimination of the public health threat by reducing new infections by 90% and death by 65% by 2030. Officials say it can be done if countries show the political will and invest in available tools to rid the world of the ailment. They say the epidemic of hepatitis B, which mainly affects the African and Western Pacific regions, can be prevented by vaccinating infants against the disease. In regard to hepatitis C, the director of the WHO Department of HIV Global Hepatitis Program, Gottfried Hirnschall, says there's been a sea change in the treatment of this disease. He tells VOA, until 4 years ago, no good treatment existed for hepatitis C, which kills nearly 400,000 people annually.
Then we saw the revolution. New drugs came on the market that are really fantastic drugs that have very limited side effects. You only have to take them for 3 months, and 95% or more are cured. And even those who are not cured in the first round, we now have even alternatives that we can provide to those.
Hirnschall notes the revolutionary kickoff of the new drugs was hampered by the huge $84,000 cost for the three-month course of treatment. But he says the cost in developing countries now has dropped to between $260 and $280. A survey of 28 countries, representing about 70% of the global hepatitis burden, finds efforts to eliminate hepatitis are gathering speed. It says nearly all the countries have set up high-level elimination committees, and more than half are allocating money to move the process forward. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
After many years of embracing cuisine from other parts of the world, South Africans are finally learning to appreciate the food and recipes of their home continent. Eateries serving the traditional tastes of Africa are springing up across the country. Finally, it's fashionable in South Africa to enjoy African food, from Tanzanian's mchuzi wa samaki or fish curry to West African beef, plantain and okra stew. Ethiopian dishes are proving to be particularly popular. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports in our series on South Africa's belated discovery of Africa's rich cuisine heritage.
A customer pays for a meal at the Abyssinia restaurant in southern Johannesburg. Patrons sit on cushions covered with multicolored embroidered cloth. At tables woven from grass, intense aromas waft from the kitchen. Almost 20 years ago, Amsale Debela walked from Addis Ababa to the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. She says she had to leave Ethiopia because her family opposed the state's anti-democratic policies. Her brother, Ermias, interprets her words.
The arresting for my father and the arresting also my sister.
Amsale's objective was to reach South Africa.
From Kenya and Tanzania, across with the ships from Dar es Salaam to Mutwara, the border of Mozambique and Tanzania. After Mozambique, we are crossing with the load, with the truck. We are sleeping in the bush.
The lorry ferried her and other migrants into Swaziland. Amsale remembers being dressed in rags. In Swaziland, fellow Ethiopians clothed, fed her, and helped her onto a bus to Johannesburg. In the city, a friend gave her 150 rand, today worth little more than $10, to buy goods to sell in the streets.
And I starting to selling for the toothbrush and the wallet and the belts. Now I get the small shop I'm running for my business. Thanks, God.
Amsale makes her journey from Ethiopian refugee to hawker in Johannesburg to owner of a successful restaurant sound easy. But she worked the streets for 15 years to save enough to open her business.
She have a lot of customers, Ethiopians, Kenyans, some white peoples. Now also the South African people also they came and they enjoy for our traditional foods. Thank you.
Abyssinia's cooks prepare Ethiopian dishes, hot berbere or chili, doro wat chicken casserole, and kiwat beef stew. The top sellers, though, are the tibs, sliced and spiced lamb, goat or beef, pan-fried in garlic, onion and tomato. Many dishes are favored liberally with niter kebe, spiced butter. The saucy concoctions are mopped up by hand with injera, spongy pancakes made from teff grain. Amsale rounds off the food she serves with world-famous Ethiopian coffee. She's proud of her achievements, but life remains tough in South Africa's biggest metropolis, especially for African immigrants. A few years ago, robbers surrounded Amsale at an intersection in the city center.
When I crossing there, three guys they take out the gun without nothing, even in my pocket. I wasn't having 20 rand for the transportation. They want to take him for my life. Some of them, they have the knife.
Her sister and assistant, Rose, says she understands that criminals everywhere target people for money. But she can't grasp why some South Africans discriminate against the Debalas simply because they're immigrants.
Some people, you know, they say so, go back home. This is not your land, this is our land. And they're swearing us, you are foreigners, you eating our money, you taking our wife. I don't know why they're hating us, but it's fine, still we are alive.
The Debela Eatery is indeed a place where people come to celebrate the joy of being alive. But with tears in his eyes, Ermias says he and his sisters dream of returning to their relatives in Ethiopia.
We are eating together, we are sharing the church together. That's why I miss Addis. I miss my home, I miss my nation. I don't have any words to explain.
Amsale and Rose say they appreciate each morsel they prepare for guests because they recall going weeks without food when they were fleeing Ethiopia. As Amsale puts it, people can hate you, they can jail you, but there is nothing as bad as hunger. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll preview the August 8th Kenyan presidential race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga. The latest public opinion polls say the ballot is too close to call. That's on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA and you are listening to Nightline Africa. And see to come in the program, sports. A commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and of course, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And now, in Late Lane Africa Sports, Milton Micho Serejovic has terminated his contract as coach of Uganda's national team over the issue of unpaid wages. His future as coach of the Cranes had been the source of much speculation all week, which led him meeting Uganda FA FUFA officials on Monday. On Saturday, Micho confirmed in a press conference that he was leaving his position. The 47-year-old had been in his position as Uganda's coach since appointment in May 2013. During his tenure, he famously guided the Cranes to the first Africa Cup of Nations finals in 39 years when they qualified for Gabon 2017. Micho has a long history in African football, having also coached in Ethiopia, Sudan, South Africa, Tanzania, and Rwanda. Uganda's Football Federation now has looked for a new coach for their next set of 2018 World Cup qualifiers. The Cranes, who are currently second in Group E, take on Egypt at home on August 31st and then away on September 5th. In athletics, a four-time Olympic champion Mo Farah is delaying his track retirement to race in the Diamond League final in Zurich on August 24th. That's according to organizers. The 34-year-old Farah says his last race on the track in Britain will be the 3,000 meters at the Birmingham Grand Prix on August 20th. But having qualified for the 5,000 meters Diamond League final, he's now set to end his track career in Switzerland. He'll focus on marathons after the World Championships in London, which ran from August 4th to 13th. Farah won European 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters gold in Zurich in 2014. He won the 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters gold at both the London 2012 and Rio 2016 Olympics. He will attempt a third successive 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters double at the World Championships next month. Zurich is not the final IAAF Diamond League event of the year, but is the conclusion of the men's 5,000 meters, with the event not included in the Brussels program in September. Meanwhile, more than 660,000 tickets have already been sold for the IAAF World Championships London 2017. Organizers announced the latest sales figure for tickets for the championships, which are set to start on Friday, August 4th. The championships will also kick off with a bumper opening weekend, with a quarter of a million spectators set to flock the London Stadium over the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday sessions. Organizers will this week issue the last remaining small batch of tickets for all 14 stadium sessions. In tennis, 12-time Grand Slam champion Novak Djokovic will not play again in 2017 because of an elbow injury. Former world number one Djokovic retired injured during his Wimbledon quarterfinal match against Thomas Badish on July 12th. He claimed to have been suffering from an elbow problem for 18 months. Djokovic said he would spend the time building up his fitness and strength, as well as working on areas of his game he felt needed to be improved. This means Djokovic will miss the US Open, which starts on August 28th, and where he was champion in 2011 and 2015. Lastly, and on a sad note, at least two people have been killed and 17 injured in a crash at South Africa's biggest stadium, according to football officials. It took place during the Soweto Derby between football clubs Kaizer Chiefs and Orlando Pirates in Johannesburg. Orlando Pirates said the crash happened when people attempted to push their way through the gates into the 87,000 capacity FNB Stadium. Authorities allowed the preseason cup game to continue. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Yes, yes, indeed, it's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and it's the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
try. July. Now why?
Don't go to no more pretend.
Now why?
I thought you'd pretend.
I try.
Never go fix love again.
July.
Hey,
my body, my body, my shoddy, my lovey be mommy. My new send my over there for me. My money, my city, my money. But this shit I'm in.
Up the earth, you light up my life. The only one I ever see with a smile so bright. Hey, and just yesterday, you came around my way. You changed my horse in way with your astonishing beauty. Oh, you couldn't make a brother sing. No ordinary thing, a supernatural being. And no, you are brighter than the moon, brighter than the star. I love you just the way you are. And you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been yet. You make my heart go ting-a-ling-a-ling. Oh, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty. Yeah, yeah, yeah. million. You stand as one, the outstanding one. I look into your eyes, girl, what I see is paradise. Hey, you captivated my soul. Now every day I want you more. I cannot deny this feeling I'm feeling inside. No other cannot take your place. They cannot take your space. That is a fact I cannot erase. And no, you are the one that makes me smile. Make me float like a boat upon the Nile. Girl, you are my African queen. The girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been. You make my heart go jingling, darling. Yeah. You are my African queen. The girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, yeah. And that is the African beauty, yeah. Oh, 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 yeah, yeah. Ooh, you are my African queen, and I know, oh yes, I know. You are my African queen, and I know. See, I know what I am feeling in my heart and in my soul. Oh, I know that it is love. And I know that this love was surely sent from up above. Cause you're the only one that I think of. You are my African queen. And I know that this means that you're the only one that I will serve. I'll give you my heart, my love, my body and my money. Every other thing you think of. In a man who could think of anything better than you. Who could think of ever hurting you? Sacrifice my all, I'll give it all to you. You are my African queen, for real.
You are my African queen. The girl of my dream.
The girl of my dream.
You may have never been.
Oh, na na, yeah.
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Despite the attempts by the government of South Sudan to suggest that the situation in the country is being normalized, the war continues, the people of South Sudan continue to flee their country and move to neighboring countries as refugees, and the humanitarian crisis deepens. This is why it is so regrettable that the developments last week would suggest that we are going nowhere to reconcile the parties in dispute. The week began by some confusion. There were reports that some were suggesting that the 2015 agreement signed by President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar had collapsed and there was a need to have a new agreement. There was immediate pushback by members of the opposition saying that even though there are problems with the agreement, it remains vital and that it should be implemented. The next problem was the announcements by the ministerial meeting of IGAD in Juba. It stated that in preparation for its revitalization forum that will take place in September in Juba, Riek Machar could send delegations or that he himself should not participate. And this provoked strong reaction from opposition forces as well as the civil society in South Sudan. The question then is, why is Riek Machar still a roadblock? It may be recalled that the African Union had delegated the Intergovernmental Authority of Development, IGAD, to assist the people of South Sudan to bring peace to that country. Hitherto, IGAD was in favor of participation of all the parties, but now it seems that there is a change in the stance, and this may be a problem. Now, there has been also some discussion in the past by the Troika being the United States, the United Kingdom, and Netherlands, that Riek Machar should stand aside. And again, there have been opposition within South Sudan for that position. What is strange is that President Salva Kiir, who is opposed to any involvement of Riek Machar, have been looking for reconciliation with all South Sudanese except Riek Machar. And the latest incident happened last week also, when President Salva Kiir paid an official visit to Uganda. And while he was in Kampala in the presence of President Museveni, he sought reconciliation with the widow of John Garang, Rebecca John Garang. Mrs. Garang said that she had no problem reconciling with President Salva Kiir, but that she would not return to Juba until all opposition and government forces are reconciled. The fact of the matter is this. Even though one may want to keep Riek Machar out of negotiation, even when he is either under house arrest or in exile in South Africa, he still controls the troops on the ground. And those troops are fighting as the supporter of Dr. Riek Machar. So one has to be very realistic. You cannot bring peace to South Sudan unless you include all parties, particularly Dr. Riek Machar. And until the government of South Sudan changes its position on this issue, regrettably, the people of South Sudan will continue to die and to suffer. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Haitians will get a boost in nutrition thanks to a joint program between United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, and Government of Haiti. On July 21st, U.S. Chargé d'Affaires Brian Shukin joined with Haiti's Ministry of Health, USAID, and RANFOS, the first food fortification project of Haiti. RANFOS will increase the availability of high-quality fortified staple foods across the country and expand the local production and importation of fortified foods. The project will work with the private sector, including local food producers and importers, to ensure the market viability to reach a wide population throughout the country, said Shukin. Ranfos directly contributes to the government of Haiti-led efforts to improve the nutrition, health, and food security per the government of Haiti's Nutrition Strategic Plan 2013 to 2018. The project aims to decrease deficiencies in micronutrients, which play a vital role in the well-being of children, mothers, and other individuals. For over a year, USAID has been working with the Ministry of Health and other partners, such as the United Nations Children's Fund, to develop a food fortification activity. In a recently released study financed by the Canadian Embassy, the Copenhagen Consensus Center identified food fortification, specifically wheat flour with iron, as one of the most efficient investments in Haiti's development. The RANFOS project will focus on fortifying wheat flour with iron and folic acid, vegetable oils with vitamin A, and salt with iodine. USAID will work with partners of the Americas and Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition to implement this $4 million four-year health and nutrition project. USAID is devoted to working closely with the Haitian government to ensure the sustainability of these joint efforts to improve the nutritional status of the entire population. Additional programs in which USAID collaborates with the government of Haiti to promote nutrition and combat malnutrition include a food pyramid guide for consuming nutritious local foods and a voucher safety net program to increase access to locally produced foods among vulnerable households. The U.S. is proud to work with its partner Haiti to help the people of Haiti meet their important nutrition needs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.